Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm happy to have as my guest today Rob Lipton. Rob Lipton is a co-coordinator for A Jewish Voice for Peace, which is based here in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. He has just returned from the occupied territories in the West Bank, where he was with an international solidarity movement, a big international solidarity movement, and we're going to hear some details about these organizations and about his experience. And right now it is, I want to say when we're talking, because things are changing very fast, and we just hope they will change for the better by even the time you hear this interview. Right now it's, I think, April 17th. So, Rob, tell us about the organizational aspect, just to sort of get a context here.
Okay. Thanks for having me on, Sue. The Jewish Voice for Peace has been around for about 6 years, and one of our main goals at this point is to end the occupation and to have justice for all people in the regions. In particular, we would like the Palestinians to be able to have an independent, or their ability to be able to run their own lives. I went on the International Solidarity Movement third scheduled program last March 29th through April 12th. We were supposed to do civil disobedience, for example, rebuilding demolished homes, picking olives in olive groves that were considered off limits by the Israeli military, maybe going through checkpoints, dismantling roadblocks, and things like that.
And it did indeed happen. Did you do that? I think I can guess.
Well, in fact, what happened was, as we were flying over, the Netanya Passover bombings occurred literally while we were in flight. And Sharon used that as the kind of excuse to go in very hard into the West Bank. Now, it's clear that the military push into the West Bank was being planned for some time, and they were waiting for any particular excuse to do that. So when we got on the ground, it was a completely different story. It wasn't a kind of a typical occupation situation or intifada situation where we could probably do typical civil disobedience. We were in an oncoming war situation.
So just to be there is civil disobedience, I would think. I mean, because they're not real thrilled about, the Israelis anyway don't want people to come in, right? Well, you tell me.
Well, we were there already. We got in just before. We came in literally on the Easter weekend, Good Friday through Easter Sunday. And Bethlehem is right near Jerusalem. It wasn't that hard to get in at that point. There were some roadblocks, but those are easy to get around. But there wasn't a military attack or encirclement at that point. Mm-hmm. But we got there, and we were thinking, well, this is an interesting, different situation. We saw the armor starting to come around the Bethlehem area. We tried to act very quickly on our feet. We were supposed to have a two-day kind of nonviolence training, and that got truncated to half a day. And we started to we thought that the best thing these internationals could do, and we were from all different countries in Europe and in the U.S., the best thing we could do at one point.
How many of you were there?
Well, we were expecting between 80 and 100, and there were another 200 Italians that were around the vicinity. Of the people in the International Solidarity Movement, they were, for example, people from the, you know, Great Britain, Ireland, France, Switzerland, Germany, Scandinavian countries, specifically Sweden, Italy, then we had about 20 people from the United States. The thing about this group, and I can't emphasize this enough, is there was no specific political orientation. There were maybe four or five people of Jewish extraction, so to speak. Very few people really had a strong understanding of what was going on in the Middle East, and they had very different political orientations, as I repeated. For example, in our group from the U.S., there were, at least from what I could identify, at least three people who said they were Republican. And they were all different ages, by the way, grandparents, retirees, to young college students. We even had two Israelis involved, which is quite brave of them. Now, our group is in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle to get rid of the occupation. It's led by Palestinians and a Canadian and Israeli woman, Netta Golan, as part of that. They were most of the leadership was stuck in Ramallah. As you know, as we came in, there was a lot of action in Ramallah keeping Arafat where he was, and the internationals were trying to get humanitarian aid into the area and to get wounded people out. So at that point, people in our group were starting to get press notoriety. World attention was slowly starting to focus. We were gathered in Bethlehem. Those leaders couldn't make it, so it was a very disorganized, for obvious reasons, understandable reasons. It was a very disorganized situation. But we tried to do the best we could. So our first actions, for example, was to march through the Dehesha refugee camp, which is in the Bethlehem area, to let the Dehesha camp population know we were there, and to let the Israelis know we were there, because there's a Israeli, some kind of garrison at one end of the camp. And we walked also through the village of Bethlehem as well to let people know we're here. And we were based at the Bethlehem Star Hotel, which happens to be the place where most of the international press ended up, because it's only about a quarter of a mile from Manger Square. So that's the setting, and we didn't know quite what we were going to do, but we were thrown into this maelstrom. You know, fresh off the plane, we're almost at the center eye of a hurricane.
And you don't even know each other, hardly, much less. Had you been there before?
No, I hadn't been there before. I know a great deal about the politics and history of the region. I've been working on peace and justice issues for the Palestinians for maybe 15, 20 years. But I hadn't been there, and I thought this is a good way to go, because then I could be on the ground doing good work.
Well, that's very brave. I'm sure it must have been scary.
It was very anxiety-producing, because we didn't know what to expect. The next day, we, for example, did a little march up to the Israelis were starting to move. The Israeli occupation forces were starting to move into the area, and they had occupied parts of Beit Jala, which is right up the hill from right next to Bethlehem. It's about a half mile walk. Mm-hmm. So we decided to walk up to the personnel carriers and do a protest. And we did that, and we made ourselves known, and they threw a few percussion grenades, which aren't really that bad. I was filming, I was doing videography, and one of those landed like 3 or 4 feet from me and it exploded, and it was loud, but it wasn't a big deal, and they kind of waved us off, and we just wanted to say we're here. So we went back to our headquarters in Bethlehem, and it was a relatively orderly march, but it was a typical civil disobedience type of thing. It was mostly to let everyone in the region know there were internationals there. Go ahead.
I'm with you. I'm definitely interested, because I just think it's very impressive that people leave the comforts of their own at their own situations and all those places and go put themselves in a war middle of a war situation and bombs dropping, even though that wasn't exactly what you expected. And there are more and more people going all the time. We're very lucky to have here in the Bay Area a lot of access to information. Right. We have KPFA for one thing, so we're hearing constant, they've been doing like a whole day today, constant reports from people with cell phones right on the spot in the midst of all the horrors, and most people just have the corporate media to relate to, and it's a whole different story, I understand. So that's why I was so anxious to speak to you and so happy to have this opportunity. So maybe we'll spread the what's really going on information to more people. And anyway, I think it's very heartening anytime people stand up and of course you who risk your lives, it's even more impressive, and that's what we need a lot of.
Well, it's an interesting situation. We didn't go, and I think most people didn't really understand in a full-blooded way what was about to occur, and how could we? So, but it looked bad. So we said, oh, the Israelis are starting to encircle the region. It's a relatively enclosed region. And so what was our game plan? Well, it looked like the idea was we would go into the camps. There are three main camps in the Bethlehem area, Dehesha, Aida, and Laza. And we would also try and do ambulance attendance work because the Israelis had targeted ambulances many times in the past, and it would be good to have internationals present. And then also the idea was in the camps we would act as hopefully a deterrent to the Israelis to act in the most kind of heinous way, so maybe we could ease that a little bit if they decided to attack into the camps. So we did that. In the first night, it wasn't a problem. The Israelis weren't really encircled too tight. But the next night, Easter Sunday, we actually all gathered the next morning afternoon in Manger Square just to be there with other internationals. There was about 300 or 400 people. Plus, there was a lot of Palestinian Authority policemen as well as militia. They gathered there because they knew in an attack that they would. The idea was they knew they were going to be targeted, so they were going to go into the Nativity Church because they didn't want to be killed by the Israeli military, which they seemed to have been doing in Ramallah. So these quote-unquote gunmen were official gunmen in the same way the New York City Police Department have gunmen. Most of the gunmen now in Nativity Church are, for the most part, they're supposed to have those weapons. Some may not. Maybe 10 or 11 of those may indeed be specific people Israel is looking for. Again, just because they're looking for them, it doesn't necessarily mean they legally have the right to. But for the most part, when you hear in the press the word gunmen, it's a complete gloss of what it actually might be. They're oftentimes policemen or legally sanctioned militia. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that was in the morning of Sunday, Easter Sunday, or early afternoon, and then we went to the camps again. This is when Israel moved its armor all around the camps, as if they would invade at any particular time. That was a little scarier. That was a harder night. It was a very hard night because they started flying their F-16s and Apache helicopters. They were starting to come in.
That are paid for by our tax money,
right,
as Americans.
And so I guess I could act as an observer to see, in fact, if our money's being used wisely. And, in fact, they seemed to fly the planes okay, and the Apache helicopters were flying well. It was a very scary situation, and we didn't know what to expect. We thought, the Palestinians thought that the invasion was imminent. It had been in the past. I was staying at the Aida camp with about 10 or 11 other people of different nationalities, English, Swedish, French, Italian, American, Irish. I was staying at the Children's Center, which was right next to, in the center of the camp. And we were there, and we were hosted by this wonderful man, and he ran the center. He was a PhD in biology. Came back. He was born and raised in the camp. This is a camp that's 50 years old. And he came back from France to work with his people. And he also taught at the university in Bethlehem. And it was just striking, the amazing amount of, these people had been living under this occupation, this oppression for so long. And you'd think they would just have this terrible sensibility about them, but they didn't. They were, unbelievably gracious under this terrible situation. And they didn't just sort of survive, they seemed to live their lives, or try to, under the humiliations and depredations of, you know, the occupation. So it was an eye-opening experience, and it was really hard that night, but the thing that kept me going was the fact that there were Palestinians had to do this all the time, and they were afraid too. And it was just something I struggled with the whole night. I didn't go to sleep. And the next morning I woke up, quote-unquote woke up, and I was just so happy to hear birds and see the dawn. And they didn't attack. The Israeli forces did not attack. Who knows why? The Palestinians in the camp seemed to think it was somewhat due to us. It's not clear that that was the Israeli plan of attack. I think in this last round, they're targeting the Palestinian authority's ability to govern itself. So municipal buildings, the Palestinian police, almost all typical government entities, for example, were either destroyed or stripped by the Israeli forces. In Ramallah, that's the case. In Nablus, that's the case. They destroyed the municipal, they heavily damaged the municipal building in Manger Square. That's where the Palestinian Authority municipal building is, like the police department and the museum and whatever municipal other governing offices there were. Apparently they've gone so far as to strip out hard drives from computers, confiscate records, whatever. So it's a pretty interesting situation.
Yeah. And now, I'm just hearing all the time these reports of rotting bodies and mass graves and torture and tying people up and then shooting them. And so I would like to know, Rob Lipton, a few things. I'd like to remind people that you are a coordinator of A Jewish Voice for Peace, an organization that's based here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And you say you've been working in support of the Palestinians and against the occupation for 20 years, something, a while. And so I'm sure everybody asked you about this, and I'm going to too, the whole issue. Actually, I have a friend who said, lives on the East Coast, and I asked her on a phone conversation, we don't talk too often, and we're close friends, about how she felt about this situation. And she said, well, because I'm Jewish, therefore I'm on the side of the Israelis. However, I really feel a lot of pain about what every time a Palestinian gets killed. And I know she's this kind of person. I didn't even want to argue with her because I knew she didn't have access to information. And I just said, well, there's a lot of the people who are protesting around here are also Jewish. So I would like you to address that.
Well, that's a really important issue. I'm glad you brought it up. A Jewish Voice for Peace is one of the implicit ideas is not in our name. We will not have our Jewish traditions, our culture, taken over and dragged through the mud, essentially, by this ridiculous policy that, you know, the Israelis have, U.S.-supported policy that is ongoing against the Palestinians. We do not believe that this occupation in any way or form is justified. It's illegal. What's going on now we consider to be war crimes, essentially. And the idea is that we are Jewish too, and there is room for us to articulate our position to say, as Jews, as Jewish Americans, we will not accept this. This is not representative of our views. It is not a monolithic sensibility in the U.S. regarding, you know, the illegal occupation. The other part of this is we're Americans. Whether you're Jewish or not, the U.S. is directly responsible for enabling Israel's occupation to continue. It's almost like we're feeding a junkie. We're giving a junkie heroin. The Israelis have a huge amount of fear, and we're allowing that to have free reign. And by giving so much military aid, unencumbered military aid to Israel, we effectively tell them, take your fears and have the and do what you need to assuage them.
Well, the other question I wanted to ask you actually is about what's all this about, this kind of going the extra mile to torture people and plow down houses with bulldoze down houses with people in them and go back and forth over them and turn them into mincemeat, going back and forth with bulldozers. I mean, really out there stuff. I mean, not that it hasn't gone on in other parts of the world, but, you know, what is all that about?
Well, the final chapter hasn't been written on what's going on in Jenin. We don't know what the death toll will be. My sense, independent of that, is Israel wanted to make an example out of Jenin to try and scare the Palestinians, similar to what happened in Deir Yassin in 1948, where about 248 Palestinians in a village right next to Jerusalem, essentially, were slaughtered purposely in order to create fear and to easily, quote-unquote, terrorize the population. We don't quite know what's going on there. The Israelis claim it was fierce, you know, fighting. Well, they need to justify themselves in some way, but when the world's fourth largest army goes up against people armed with Kalashnikovs and homemade little kerosene bombs and whatever, you have to start wondering what's really going on. Now, one thing, we all know about the tanks, we all know about the Apache helicopters, the F-16s, the armored personnel carriers, but they're most terrifying weapon by far are these huge armored bulldozers. They're literally 2-3 stories high. They have giant shovels in the front, maybe 12-14 feet high. I think they're designed without the armor for mining operations. And they have a giant hook in the back that is very useful for ripping up a road very quickly. And when you see those, you have to take a double take because you can't believe you're not looking at some Star Wars type of machine that's designed for some huge amount of damage, which in fact it is.
Right. Are those American or are those Israeli? Because Israel makes a lot of weapons too, right?
It seems, I've been told they're Caterpillar, the company. They're Caterpillar bulldozers. And
well, that's right in Illinois, near where I came from. And the Caterpillar company is in Decatur, Illinois.
They're simply awesome and terrifying machines. And I saw those moving into Bethlehem, and they haven't used them very much in Bethlehem. I think it's because it's such an important Christian city, you know, for the world Christianity. So, but they were used in Ramallah, and they were used in Nablus. They are used clearly in Jenin, and I'm not sure what they're thinking. I'm not sure what the Israelis are thinking now. Their calculations, they might have gone a little too far in Jenin, but for the most part, the world community, notwithstanding the rhetoric, is accepting their depredations against the Palestinians. There's been virtually no breaking of diplomatic ties, no strong censure in the UN. Even in the Arab world, there isn't a great deal of what you would expect to see. So their calculations up to a point have proven correct. The scary thing for me is Colin Powell was there. And during the time he was there, Israel just kept on doing what they were doing.
And didn't, Egypt refused to speak to him, right? And
well, the Hosni Mubarak refused to speak to him. I think it was a similar level cabinet person to Colin Powell that spoke to him from Egypt. Mm-hmm. And he got nowhere in the Arab world, but it didn't really matter. You know, meeting Arafat under those conditions, it's like visiting someone in jail. And it's not like two sovereign countries that are supposed to negotiate a peace. It's outrageous. It's outrageous. And then at the same time, we're claiming, you know, in the U.S. press, which is so biased for the most part, Arafat has all this control over his population. You can't be serious. I mean, that no one except maybe Israeli or American media believes that. I mean, he has no control at this point, and especially because the Israelis are targeting his ability to control. They're destroying that. And yet at the same time, they're saying he needs to control those bombers. Well, that's just cynicism on the part of the Israelis. I mean, it's totally calculated. And that the U.S. is supporting that will have terrifying effects in this country, the U.S., because everyone in the world knows that Israel would never be able to get away with this if it wasn't for such complete U.S. support. So we should expect, and I'm not in any way thinking this is a good thing, because all violence against civilians should be condemned, but I suspect that there will be an increase in violence against civilians, American civilians, in the not too near future, and there will be an increase of suicide bombers in Israel, and it just seems like this war on terrorism is actually producing more terror. It certainly seems like it from, you know, our vantage point. Another thing is, an American Jew, when I see other American Jews wholeheartedly supporting Israel now, that to me is scarce. It's very scary, because we are essentially, what they're saying to the world is, yes, Israel, great, keep it going, destroy the Palestinian cities. It's almost like our own version of a Nuremberg rally. And I think that's going to increase anti-Semitism in the world, because you have all these, you know, these Jewish Americans going to these large rallies saying, yes, Israel, go for it, you know, we support you. And that seems outrageous. And I, as an American Jew, a Jewish American, have to say, no, not in my name. This is outrageous. It's illegal. It's simply another, you know, the extension of the 50-year-old or 100-year-old land grab that's been going on against the Palestinians. Most Jewish people in those large rallies supporting Israel would just on the same level say, yeah, what we did to the Indians in the U.S. was awful. Well, we took their land. And sometimes the Indians fought back, or they killed a bunch of civilians in a village, and we said, bad Indians. Well, but at this point, the Indians lost most of their land, their lives have been completely disrupted. I don't see why that argument can't easily be placed, you know, in the Middle Eastern context. Yeah. So.
Well, Rob Lipton, we don't really have much time to discuss this. If you could say in 30 seconds what you want to see happen next. Okay. And then we're going to give a web page, so get ready for that.
I think people need to go there, whether you're Jewish or not Jewish. It's about that we are the grassroots UN, these internationals. The regular UN has failed. The international community has failed. You can reach, you can get some information off the web. It's www.rapprochement.org, and I think that's spelled RAPPROUNCEMENT. .org.
Is it French? Because that's not how I spelled. That's not how it's spelled in English.
You can try it either way. Look, you could search on the net, or you can reach a Jewish Voice for Peace at www.jewishvoiceforpeace.org. And this is an ongoing process. There's going to be a lot of people trying to get into the West Bank, and it's been exponentially growing over the last couple of weeks. And we've never had such access to the media or interest in us before. This is unprecedented. I think it's because it's the first time the world at some level has said enough, and that's what we're saying too. We need to get there. We need to think very seriously about what's going on, because this can't keep on happening. These people have been oppressed for so long. It doesn't just hurt them, Palestinians, but it certainly is corroding and corrupting the Israeli society.
And there's a lot of things we need to say enough about, and that's certainly at the top of the list there, the Middle East. Okay, thank you very, very much, Rob Lipton, co-coordinator of A Jewish Voice from Peace, and just back from the West Bank in occupied territories where he went with the International Solidarity Movement. My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.